Welcome to the Accelerating Operational Performance Podcast. I'm Greg Schenkel, President of Unique Training and Development and Frontline Leadership Systems. And today's episode is brought to you by our new Frontline Leadership Program. People who've done business with us before know that we've always had this Frontline Leadership Program. It's our cornerstone program. And it's traditionally been a 6 half-day or 3 full-day program for supervisors and team leads. Now the program's been expanded. So what used to be just the Frontline Leadership course is now called the Frontline Leadership Strength and Essentials Program. And we have two new tiers in the program portfolio for people that have covered the basics but want to take their learning to another level. Frontline Leadership Drive Performance is the second tier in the program, and then there's Frontline Leadership Amplify Impact. So if any of that is of interest to you, of course, reach out and talk to us at our website at uniquedevelopment.com. Today's guest, I'm really excited because this guest and I actually, as it turns out, have our paths intertwined several times. It's been actually a decade since we actually did some work together, but Jonathan Chase, who's my guest, he really made an impact on me when we did work together back in one of his plants, and we'll certainly get into some of that. But let me introduce our guest, Jonathan Chase. So John is the VP of Marketing and Shared Services for John Deere's Ag and Turf Division. This includes supporting products from lawnmowers to the mass channel to small tractors and Gator utility vehicles on a hobby farm to large combines and four-wheel drive tractors you see across the plains of the Midwest. I had the pleasure of working with John and his team almost 10 years ago at the John Deere Seeding Factory in Moline, Illinois, where John was the factory manager of Deere's oldest factory. It was built in 1878. I remember one of the machines could plant, like I think the one I saw, I mean, it wasn't even one that was built in that factory, but we went on a field trip and it could plant up to 64 rows. I think the one in that factory, John, was a little bit less. And the amount of automation in farming and the technology involved is truly impressive. John has his Bachelor of Science in Mechanical Engineering from Kettering University, where as it turns out, he attended a few years after I was there. And he earned his MBA at the Harvard Business School. He's held multiple roles over his 23-year career at John Deere, including sales, marketing, business development, manufacturing engineering, and factory operations leadership. He's also lived in Mannheim, Germany for 4 years, supporting Deere's European operations. Glad you could join us on the show today, John.
It's great to be here, Greg. It's great to see you after all these years.
Yeah, for sure. And the other thing that I mentioned, and we had a little discussion before we started the podcast, is I said to John, we also ran into each other at Epcot Center, just fluky. He was there with his family. I was there with mine. And we just ran into each other at the Germany Pavilion, I believe it was, at the back of Epcot Center. So that was also a serendipity, I think. And by the way, if you need to connect with Jonathan Chase, you can, of course, find him on LinkedIn. And if you're interested in the products that Deere and the solutions that Deere provides, you can visit that website at deere.com. So, John, I guess the first question is, you've had a really neat career, and of course, no slouch going to Harvard for your MBA and going to Kettering for your engineering degree. What I'm curious of is, and you had the same co-op experience I did in the early days, I always think in your early days you have a lot of potential confidence and certainly a lot of potential, but there's usually this time when you either run a project or get involved with something and it becomes sort of that thing that makes you go, I think I got something here. It's a true boost to your confidence because of something that went well. What's one of those successful projects that you remember earlier on in your career that really helped you figure out maybe I am on the right path here?
Yeah, interesting. Certainly one of the projects that I'm most excited to talk about and was a great experience was the one that you were a part of. Oh, let's see, about 12, 13 years ago, when I had the opportunity to be the factory manager at Seeding in Moline. So to kind of put you in the context of what we were going through, this is a factory that has about 500 production employees. We were in the process of delivering a new product to the market that really was going to revolutionize the way in which our customers were able to plant seeds in the ground, be able to go twice the speed of what they had done for the previous 50 years. At the same time, we had about a $50 million investment into the factory, new paint system, and all that. And we were going through a change in the market where, we're in a cyclical business. We were going from kind of a peak all the way to a trough, and the change in which that was. And I would say having all of that come together in one spot, and being able to work through that change, product, market, and the facilities with a team to be able to kind of lay out, okay, here's our vision, here's why we're doing what we're doing, and how do you keep people engaged through that was something I was most proud of. And that's kind of where I said, I've got an engineering background, I've got a little bit of marketing background, but you bring all that together in a leadership position, and it's important to be able to do that communication and so on in a factory environment. It's not just about running the numbers. It's about engaging people in the vision and where you're trying to go that I think is super important. So that's the project when all that came together that I'm probably most proud
Awesome. I'm glad that I was around there, at least towards the
of.
tail end of that implementation. I have an off book question for you, just because you mentioned how things can go up and down. And I mean, having been in the business for 23 years, my guess is you've seen a few different cycles. And again, in different market segments, it probably cycles a little bit differently sometimes. I'm just curious how you yourself just handle that, or if you were talking to somebody maybe who is newer to Deere or newer to be in that sort of up and down process, or that business cycle, how do you manage the highs and the lows? Because I'm sure there's times when you feel like, oh, we can't do anything wrong. We can ship every product we have, at good prices and good margins. And then there's other times where even if we wanted to sell this thing, we can't get a buyer for it. So I'm just wondering, how do you manage the ups and downs, knowing that it's still a fairly cyclical business?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest is to take a longer term view of it and try not to have knee-jerk reaction to things. I mean, it's very similar to how I think, working in a factory in the beginning days, someone would come to me and, here's a problem, and it's like, okay, let's drop everything and go after and fix it. And then you get into it and go, well, there's maybe another perspective I should have thought of, and maybe I should have stopped for a minute and gotten two or three perspectives on this before I jump in and make a change. And I think it's the same thing here. Like, how do you go talk to people that maybe have been through this before, and how do you think about this in a longer term before you maybe just start making a quick decision on something?
I
And
gotcha.
certainly, certainly that's something that I've changed over time. From, hey, let's go out and fix this too. Let's make sure we really understand it before we just knee-jerk.
Yeah. Now, what amazed me in looking at your experience, because you've been in sales and business development, you've been in marketing, you've been, in a factory environment, getting product made. That's not a usual thing for most people. Now, I know, I mean, you have your business degree on top of your engineering degree, but it's interesting to me that you seem to be just as happy and comfortable in a marketing role as you were running a factory. And I'm just curious, what is that about? Because that's not usual for most people, right? They usually choose one track or another. What explains why you're pretty flexible as to which part you go back to?
Yeah, well, some maybe say I'm not very good at any of it, so I keep bouncing around. I don't know,
I don't
but
think that's the case, John. You obviously got a lot of skills and talents, but what is it that allows you to do that?
well, thanks. I think at the end of the day, it's about how do you connect with people, and especially as you go further from a leadership standpoint, it's the ability to have a vision, be able to articulate that vision, but do it in a simple way that people understand and they can see themselves in that. So, for example, one of the things that we did within the factory. So, I came into this is not a seating. This was a different factory that I had here, probably about 7, 8 years ago. I came in and it was a typical factory manager that had been there. It's all about goals and metrics, and we hit this. And I went to the first all employee meeting. Of course, we had probably about 800 or 900 different production employees, and kind of sat through that first one, and up on the slides are all of these metrics. And I'm like, I'm not even sure I understand half of these metrics, let alone the production employees are sitting there and half of them are asleep or whatever. And I came out of that and I said, my job is, no, it's not that those metrics aren't important. It's not that we aren't going to do those things, But how do we help people to understand what it is that their job really impacts, and what are the metrics that really drive that? So we started out with 48 metrics. I got it down to 28 that we would talk about. But from that, I came up with a vision that said there's four things that matter in this business. The first is, how do we live the team? How do we collectively work together as a team? And we had a couple metrics that we were going to say we were going to gauge whether we were successful in living the team. The second, are we making more fans, which is really, our external customers. Are we delivering a quality product? But even who are our internal customers? Who's the next person down the line? Are you making a fan with them, or are they not happy with it? And how could we set up metrics to do that? The third was around strengthening the franchise to say, are we getting the business better? Are there things we're improving financially? Because that financial improvement is the fuel that drives the business to continue to invest. And the fourth was innovating to win. What are we doing to bring new technology, to bring new continuous improvement to the shop floor, and to drive that improvement? So we boiled down from a bunch of metrics on a slide to saying there's four things that matter: team, fans, franchise, and innovation. And those four things are what we're going to measure on. And I used to start every meeting with those four things. I'd go out on the shop floor and I could joke with folks and say, "Hey, so what matters around here?" Yeah, live the team, But at the end of the day, our technicians on the floor felt like they were a part of it, and they could say, "Hey, these are the things that matter." And I think that's what's critical, whether you're in marketing and you got 30 seconds to do a TV commercial, or you're a leader on the shop floor, or whoever. How do you connect with people, get your message across, and have people believe in what that mission is?
Yeah, that's awesome. And it's interesting to have you talk about the KPIs and distilling them down. Of course, well, you said metrics, you didn't say KPIs, because it would be absurd to have 40 KPIs. I mean, they're not that key if there's 40 of them. But I think that's a great lesson for all leaders to know, that to distill it down. And the nice thing about the four that you chose to focus on is those are things that everyone can agree are important anyway, whereas they could disagree on maybe tactics or, how we're actually executing on certain things. So that's awesome. I'm sure as part of your career, you've had to embrace things like lean and continuous improvement and 5S and maybe even Six Sigma. And I'm just curious, what's your take on that? Because we had one of our internal experts who does a lot of work in that area, Videsh Subramanian, and he was saying that in his estimation, only a few percent of companies really do a good job of embracing and sustaining a lean sort of mindset culture. And I'm just curious what insights you have around the secrets of achieving kind of true lean and continuous improvement, and what you've seen, the good, the bad, and the ugly, so to speak.
Yeah. So, the same opportunity I just talked about, it happened to be, so I was responsible for a joint venture between Hitachi Construction and John Deere. So they were responsible for making all of the hydraulic construction excavators for North and South America. And so it was a unique mix of Japanese manufacturing with kind of US manufacturing and innovation. And so we used all the Japanese terms and Kaizen and really visual manufacturing and so on. And one of the things to me that I think was, and of course 5S was a huge part of that, and it was ingrained in the culture. And I had been part of a lot of initiatives at other factories. Oh, we need to clean up 5S, and we need to do continuous improvement. And they sort of became events, and then a couple months went by, and then you kind of go right back down. So the first and foremost is, it's not just a project or some temporary, hey, let's put this banner up on the wall and suddenly we'll get 5S. It needs to be the 20-mile march of every single day, how we set things up. And everybody is supporting that, from the manufacturing engineers on the floor, the supervisors. Like, it's a way of life. And I think from a Kaizen standpoint, we had a Kaizen program where the technicians, and maybe that's even another thing, we didn't call our production employees hourly employees or wage employees. We called them technicians because we wanted to elevate who they are and what they're about. And we would make sure when we had new engineers that came in, we made it a point to say, remember, that person out there has done this job for maybe 15, 20 years. You've been here for 6 months. Your first job is to go out and understand what it is they do and how they do it and learn from them and not try and go out and say, well, here's a better way to do it. So when you have that attitude from the top all the way through your engineers and your supply management of my job is to make that technician on the floor successful, then that technician engages in things like Kaizen because they feel supported by the group around them and they're willing to put their ideas forth to improve the production environment. If they feel like, hey, I'm at odds or whatever, why would I share my idea? You're just going to say it's stupid or that it doesn't work or
Or take
whatever. So,
credit for it, I suppose, right? You'll
or
take
not, yeah,
credit, yeah.
exactly. Or the, yeah, that engineer is going to go, great, I'm going to get a promotion because I got credit. So I think building that trust and that communication and driving a Kaizen program that's a real program and not just a banner on a wall, I think is the key to it.
You
And we
got
have
it. That was like a test, but I mean, you crushed it because, although I would say that probably what you saw in the Hitachi joint venture was you saw like a company that already had that sort of really deep belief. And I'm sure there was maybe some contrast between, maybe what you'd seen in other Deere operations that didn't have that Japanese sort of culture instilled in them as deeply. It just takes that awakening that it is a cultural shift, not a tactic and toolkit shift, right?
Exactly.
So that's really cool.
I would agree.
Here's another question, sort of out of the blue. And people, audience members should know that, we do send a few questions in advance, and then based on the conversation, I might deviate a little bit. I'm curious, this is something that we ask in our frontline leadership program. Is, to think back over some of the leaders you've worked for and how, a relatively small number of people still resonate with you sometimes a decade or more after you worked for them. And I'm curious whether anyone, you don't have to name names, but I'm just curious if anyone pops in who you still look back fondly at from earlier in your years, who just had this impact of changing your mindset or your belief system, or they just made a more, they made more of an impact than just being your supervisor.
Yeah. Well, I do remember a story that one of my supervisors told me or a advice that they gave me about probably 15 years ago. And I remember coming into his office and there was a problem that we had. And I kind of said, I'm not sure where to go with this. Where do you think I should go? And he looked at me and said, John, you're trying to take the monkey that's on your back and put it on my back. Here's my expectation is you're the closest one to the problem. I need you to come in with here's a couple alternatives and here's the recommendation that you think we should go with. And I can give you some of my experience, my advice, some of the different things, but at the end of the day, you're in the best position to do it. So you bringing that into me to make that decision, it just doesn't make sense. And I say that to people all the time now. And I'll say it, there's two different types of people that come into my office. Those that kind of come in and they got the monkey and they want to give it to me. And there's others that come in with, here's the issue. I've thought about it and I think there's option one or two or three. And I really think option two is right. What do you think? And I can tell you the difference in that conversation and even the respect I have for an employee that comes in with that attitude. It's just off the charts. And that's something I really try hard to say, look, I'm not close to this problem. It's you that needs to bring kind of those solutions. And
That's a
so I
great
can really
example.
think of that.
That's a great example, I think, for all leaders, John, is just to know that you want, instead of, I like the people can visualize the monkey on the back, right, and getting it thrown on somebody else's back. I think it's great just to ask for, hey, you brought me a problem. I'm just curious if you have any solutions. And then if they do it a couple of times and you go, let's just have a deeper conversation about, why I always ask you for solutions, right? That's actually going to cause me to go to this more recent model that we've been playing with called decision-making waste. And decision-making waste, the way it looks is you have your executive team, your VP in a factory might be the site leader. You've got your middle managers who are looking after various functions and departments. You've got your frontline supervisors, and you've got your technicians or your employees or your team members. And decision-making way says that every time I've got a person who's one or two levels above where the problem should have been solved or dealt with, it's technically a form of waste because I'm taking this technically higher value, more skilled, more experienced person, and I'm having them work on a problem that probably should be better solved closer to the work. And we say, you know, the people at the front line should really be running the business, the people in the middle should be improving the business, and the people at the top should be growing the business. So that resonates with people. And I think it kind of fits in with what you're saying, that it's just so easy to start doing the work or making decisions that should be solved lower. I'm wondering, have you seen evidence of that? I mean, you work in a very large company where people are getting involved in things that they shouldn't, or does it just take a constant reflection to say, why am I getting embroiled in this?
Yeah. It's interesting because maybe this is a corollary a little bit to what you're saying, but, you know, I also see it as presentations move up that chain of command, they get watered down a bit. And then by the time it's presented at that, you know, big meeting, you don't really know what's happening on the ground. And so, yeah, I 100% believe in what you just said. I think another part of that is when a decision is made, what I've seen in the past is sometimes frontline leadership won't take that decision as theirs. So they're standing in front of, let's say, their production employees as that frontline leader. And they're like, yeah, I don't really believe in this decision either, but this is what John said. Yeah. So that's what we're going to do. And then somebody's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. That frontline leader never really understood the why behind it. And it just undermines all the credibility that the higher level leader has, because it looks like they're out of touch, but even the credibility of that frontline leader to be like, you don't even know why we're doing this, right? So that's why I think, that's why I used to love walking the floor. That's why I love understanding like what's actually happening on the ground, so that there's a context by which these decisions are made. But two, making sure when we make a decision, that we clearly explain the why behind it. And then we used to always say to every person, like, take the extra 30 seconds when somebody has an idea or somebody says, you know, hey, let's do this, and we say, no, that's not going to work, don't end it there. Take the extra 30 seconds to explain the why behind it.
You got it.
Because if you don't, then it just becomes a friction point that people go, well, I'm not going to bring the next good idea up I have because everything I say is stupid. But if they understand the context, they might go, oh, well, how about this then? Anyway, I'm not sure I answered your question, but
no, you did. Well, you did. I think that that the explaining of why probably at every tier in that leadership system helps people understand and take more ownership of it. Funny enough, out of the 6 half days of our frontline leadership, now the Strength and Essentials program, one of the key things that people take away, one of the top 3 things, is just that reminder to explain why. So I'm glad that you reinforced
it. It works with my wife as well. So.
Good luck with
that. Or she may say it works with me.
Yes. I won't even go down that path in terms of my wife and daughter often say, you teach listening skills, don't you? One thing, though, I was curious, given that you're in marketing and, you know, I'm in a small firm, you know, we have 8 employees and another 8 project delivery folks. But I end up wearing part of the marketing hat along with our marketing coordinator and our general manager. But I'm curious what the marketing equivalent is to that walking of the factory floor. I think there is one, right? Because you need to walk alongside your customers to know what their challenges and problems are. How do you view the marketing side, even though that's not our podcast focus? But I'm just curious how you adopt that to, say, the marketing side.
Yeah, I absolutely see it. Well, one is engaging with the team, you know, internally, but we have a dealer channel. So I try and get out as much as you can with a dealer channel, because that's where really the rubber meets the road. You know, we can put whatever sales training or ads or whatever together, but if a dealer's like, yeah, I, it doesn't really resonate, we don't use it, then that's waste in the marketing system, right? And even beyond that, it's spending time with customers and understanding it, which is why I love my job. It's the ability to go out and some of the best, people in the world that are growing crops and building our roads and so on, and to see the problems they have every day and how our equipment can help with that. So we try very hard to spend a lot of time there with both our dealers and our customers, listening and understanding. And a lot of it, to be honest, are the same challenges you see within a factory of people and being able to find skilled labor and how can automation help with that. But automation is a double-edged sword because sometimes it creates more problems than it's worth. And so how do you find that balance? But
No, that's I think yeah, that sounds like it makes sense to me for sure. One area that maybe it's related to the idea of multi-tiers in the organization. One little aside I'll comment on is we have this operational priorities accelerator model, and one of the things that usually I'll ask an executive is what percentage of the key priorities that you're focused on, let's say at the senior executive level, are actually clearly understood at the front line. So that goes back to your comment of, passing on the information, explaining why, and having frontline leaders be good ambassadors in terms of information flow. But one of the side things about sort of that model is this idea of how people's incentives sometimes misalign within an organization. So the purchasing group has their key metrics or performance indicators. The manufacturing team has theirs. I suppose the marketing team has theirs, and how the arrows don't quite line up in the same way. And I wasn't sure whether you've seen that in your career, how you've seen it sort of get better aligned so that groups, because I think every group's trying to do the right thing, but sometimes in their pursuit of what they think is the right thing, it causes frustrations for another group trying to also achieve things for the end customer. Do you have any thoughts around the alignment of groups and their efforts and the measuring and incentive schemes that sometimes influence that?
I mean, to me, it's probably the number one job of senior leaders within an organization. And again, senior being, it could be the factory manager within a factory, whatever. But I mean, I spend a tremendous amount of time with my counterparts within this organization. We're actually right in the middle of our annual kind of performance management rollout and goals for next year and so on. And we spend a tremendous amount of time because I've seen it several times where we will have the same objective with two completely different numbers. And it's like, wait a minute, you need to do that. We need to do this. They should be the same number. So we spend a tremendous amount of time on that. I think there's huge power in it. The more you can simplify and the more you can show that alignment. And we have a saying, like, how do we out collaborate each other? Like that is.